This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Whenever you talk about the key players in Michigan's music scene, one of the names that inevitably comes up is that of Stuart Frankie. Born in Saginaw, he's made his home, raised his family, and built his music career in Metro Detroit. Writer and critic Jim McFarlane calls Stuart Frankie Detroit's working man's troubadour, and it's a title that he's earned and maintained over decades of making his music. But today we're going to hear about another journey Stuart Frankie has been on, a journey into the world of cancer, a journey that started when he was diagnosed with leukemia, and it forced Stu and his family and circle of friends to join together to wage what became a ferocious battle. And he's telling the story of that battle in a new ebook, and the title says it all, What Don't Kill Me Just Makes Me Strong. Stuart Frankie, welcome to Stateside.
Cynthia, how are you?
It's good to see you, and I'm sure you hear that time and time again, all these years after you won your battle.
Better to be seen than viewed.
That's absolutely true. Set the stage for us, Stu. What was life like before your diagnosis? You married, two small kids?
Yeah, I was married, children that were 2 and 4. And things were going well. My career was on the upswing. Everything was going really well. I was 37, 38 years old prior to it, and everything was going well. Music career was going well. I was playing a lot of shows. I was making my third record at the time. And I made a record called House of Lights, which was a metaphor for the fragile beauty of family life. And that's what it was. It was sort of a halcyon period.
Boy.
And when I was 39, I was diagnosed, and everything changes overnight, as most cancer patients know. It just goes from one life to another like that.
In the course of a few words from a physician.
Exactly.
You have been writing music and making music since you were a teenager. You were a little bit of a late bloomer in that you didn't release your first CD for the public until you were like 34. But you'd been writing and expressing yourself through your music. So you've got that lifelong habit of turning experiences and observations into songs. How did that skill set serve you for recounting this battle in your book?
It was funny. A good friend of mine is the critic Dave Marsh, and he said, I want to hear what you're going to do after this, which gave me a sense of hope, you know, after the transplant, and how profound it would be and how it would affect my music. And it really did. It really affected my music in a narrative sense, made it more soulful, made it more more human, less about storytelling,
maybe less in your head and more from your
less
heart?
Less in my head and more from my heart, exactly, and more about others. And because that's the biggest lesson I learned, was that we're how dependent we are upon each other, even in our anonymity. We're just profoundly dependent upon each other, even when we don't know it, you know. So that came across in the songwriting, and it really, everything changed. Everything changed from my songwriting to my lifestyle to my diet to my, my vocabulary.
You know, one might have thought because of your songwriting and your life of songwriting that you might have taken this story of your cancer battle and told it through a CD. Why a book?
Well, I was always a writer. I was a writer at the Metro Times for 10 years. I wrote a column and essays and criticism there, mostly music and film. And so I'd wanted to write a book because it was twofold. Mm-hmm. Number one is I wanted it to be sort of not a primer or anything, but a guide for people who are newly diagnosed. I wanted it to be of help to other people, first of all and foremost. And second of all, I wanted it to be cathartic in the sense that I could wrap up that period of my life, and I could do that and do that succinctly. And songs are open-ended. There's no point. There's no exclamation point or period to them. Mm-hmm. They're open-ended, and they're open to to the analysis of the listener
or the interpretation.
The interpretation of the listener.
Sure.
Even
okay.
Better. Yeah. So. so and a book is more emphatic, and there it is, and it begins and it ends, and the time period begins and it ends.
There you go. Well, I'd like to ask you to read from your book, What Don't Kill Me Just Makes Me Strong. This was actually in March of 1998, and you were out with friends skiing in Aspen.
Physically, I didn't feel like myself on this trip. I got very cold skiing and became winded easily. And my legs were like jello, an unfamiliar feeling for me as I'd been athletic most of my life, earning a scholarship to college, and even playing a European ATP satellite tennis tour in 1980. The next to last afternoon before I left, I stopped mid-mountain, puked my guts out without warning, and had to sit in the snow for quite a while just to make it back down the mountain. Later that spring, while stretching to go running in May of 98, I felt an oblong, doughy lump on the left side of my stomach just beneath my rib cage. When I took a breath, it would move up and down, in and out from under my ribs. I wasn't alarmed. I thought it was part of my stomach that I could feel now that I'd lost some weight. I was pleased with the weight loss. In the music world, images, for better or worse, are a large part of the deal. Spring became early summer. Over Memorial Day weekend, I told Julia that I just didn't feel right, that I felt tired in an odd way, and I noticed that my tongue was coated with this thick, lead-colored crap. My upper lip line had also somehow lost its bowed definition, and my fingernails were clubbed, raised, and lined in a vertical prominence. I was set to go play my weekly tennis match with my friend and basketball legend Joe Dumars, something I looked forward to and loved doing, and had to call him and beg off. Just no vitality, I told Joe. Now, a little worried and wondering about the croissant-shaped lump in my gut, I went to a walk-in clinic at Beaumont Hospital in Royal Oak, the hospital where my children were born. It was a Friday in June. I recall I was wearing all black that day, the de rigueur uniform for a rock and roller or a grave digger. The resident physician who saw me was young and very direct. He examined the abdominal lump and drew some blood and ran a full CBC. I'd been so healthy my entire life, I'd never even had my blood drawn. I waited about an hour, and he came back looking a little older, pale and drained. "Your white blood cell count is 128,000," he said. "What's that mean?" I asked. I knew very little of anatomy and concerned myself with my own health remotely. Like a lot of us in the healthy world, I took it for granted. "Well, normal is around 4,000 to 5,000. Something's very wrong, but I'm not exactly sure what. It could be an aberrant infection. However, it's likely leukemia or lymphoma. Your blood might be viscous. The lump in your abdomen is actually your spleen, bloated with red blood cells." "This can't be right," I said, stunned. "Could the blood test be wrong?" "Well, we'll order a bone marrow biopsy for Monday," he said. "Those results are the absolute, the gold standard in telling us what's going on. Call this number and your biopsy will be scheduled for Monday morning." Then he quickly broke eye contact, dropped his head, handed the paper with the numbers, and dismissed me with the detached compassion touching my knee. I couldn't tell whether he was used to handing out bad news or not. The phrase gold standard was hopeful. It seemed to suggest that there was some doubt to his diagnosis and maybe more to uncover. What I could tell by the way he treated me was that something had changed. I had definitely entered the world of the afflicted and could sense I was in big trouble.
That's Detroit singer-songwriter and now author Stuart Frankie reading from his memoir, What Don't Kill Me Makes Me Strong. And ultimately, yes, you had leukemia and you found out your best option was a bone marrow transplant. You were pretty fortunate because your sister was a match.
Very fortunate.
Because, you know, we've seen the story. Remember J.P. McCarthy?
Right.
Legendary Detroit disc jockey. He was adopted and couldn't find a match.
Couldn't find a match. He had, I think, aplastic anemia.
Yeah.
And they've made great strides with unmatched bone marrow donors. So,
but having a match,
really a genetic match, because you're a perfect match.
You've got enough going against you when you're trying to do this, and you wound up on 10 Green. That was your new home on the bone marrow transplant unit at Harper Hospital. You had a physician from the Karmanis Cancer Center guiding your treatment. Tell us about that treatment.
Well, you go in, and what they need to do, since it's the cancer is in your marrow, is they have to kill your marrow, which involves killing your immune system, because your marrow contains your white blood cells, red blood cells, platelets, and hemoglobin. So they kill it completely with with chemotherapy, high-dose chemotherapy. So you go down and you literally have no counts. You're as close to dead as you can be. And then after about 10 days of that, they engraft you with, in my case, my sister's marrow. It's just a little bag. It sounds like a big deal, but they just bring a bag in. It looks like little pink stuff, and it's a little baggy, and it goes into your center line, which goes into your heart. And the marrow goes in, and it starts to engraft, and it's miraculous. It's on that angle that it goes in, and it begins to
grow.
I grow and identify your own organs, even though there's something called graft versus host disease, where it doesn't identify all your organs. Mm-hmm. But you just feel, it's hard to describe how terrible you feel for how long. Because
well, you do it in your book very, very well, between the chemotherapy of side effects, which I think we all got a sense it can be a very hard journey. You really did give us a sense of what it was like to kind of be there in your room with you during that process.
Well, I just wanted to tell the truth as close as I could and remember as much as I could without scaring prospective patients.
Well, you had a visitor.
I did.
A strange woman walks in and you're like, who are you? Are you bringing germs in? Why are you here to see me? Tell us about that visit.
I was very wary of people coming in because you don't know. A cold or flu could kill you. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden I was sitting with my sister just talking one day. And in walks a person unannounced or anything, no knocking, no nothing. And it really made me nervous. And she walked over and she actually sat on my bed. It really made me nervous. And she just said, she was a hairdresser. And I don't remember her name. I don't remember where she was from or anything. And she just said, I've been through what you're going through, and you're going to be fine. And it was very inspirational at that point.
And she had been in your room, hadn't she?
Yeah, she had been in my room. We had shared that room. And now I do that. I go back often and go into rooms and because it's the best thing you can do. There's no words I can say. I can just say, I was as sick as you are, and now I'm back to where I was, if not better. And so it's the best thing you can do for patients at this point. They're better than words, better than anything, is just show up and say, hey, I'm here. You can make it too.
You went through so much terrible pain and side effects from the chemo and all the necessary evil to accomplish what you needed to save your life. But I'm wondering, Sue, did you get to any brink of saying, you know what, forget it. I'm out. I'm going to leave this in God's hands.
There's a certain amount of surrender that you need to fight on. And my wife said at one point, why don't you just give it up, which means a very different thing than give up. She said, just give it up to whatever you believe in. And there is a bit of a spiritual battle in my book about, I'm not sure about things. I'm not sure about the presence of God or, the distinct aspects of God's representation. And so I did that, and that really helped. I did give it up, just let it go. And there was only so much I could control, and it was very little what I could control.
But you didn't give up.
But I didn't give up. Big difference. I gave it up to the spirit, to nature, to whatever you believe in. I gave it up to, you could say God, you could say, in the book I say, I call Jesus whatever, Clem or Ned or something like that. You can call him whatever you want. Yeah. There's a spirit out there that's larger than us, and it's everywhere, and its presence is profound.
You took something that happened on the BMT unit, and you turned it into a very, very touching song that is available on the e-book when you download it. It's called Letter from 10 Green. It was a couple in a nearby room that you heard crying, and then you found out their 4-year-old daughter had died. Let's take a listen to this song.
I hear footsteps in the hall. It's 4 a.m. Ignore the nurse's call. Girl has died tonight. She struggled with this disease her entire life. Don't let me hear her mother's cries. Instead, I turn on the light and to my own children I write. Live with all your guts and soul and heart every day.
That's Detroit singer-songwriter and now author Stuart Frankie. We've been talking with him about his memoir, What Don't Kill Me Makes Me Strong. What words of, I guess the word of advice is all I can think of, would you share with people who are fighting their own crisis battle right now? Maybe it's cancer or some other ailment, and also to those who love them?
Well, those are two distinct different things, because sometimes the caretaker's role is just as difficult, if not more difficult, than the patient's. It's very fatiguing, very difficult. But to the patients, I'd say find something to believe in, find something to hold on to, because you can be in the most dire – I've seen the most dire situations that people have come out of and restored their health and gone on to live – X amount of years and are still living. And to the caregivers, it's the same thing. You have to find something to believe in, something to hold on to, something larger than ourselves, something, or it can be something real, something tangible, something, you know, just, but it has to be outside yourself a little bit. And man, I've just seen remarkable things in the human spirit from caregivers and people hanging there, particularly with children with cancer. And now, happily, you know, survival rates are up in the 90% with childhood leukemia. And so there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic about leukemia, lymphoma, and things like that.
And I know you've set up the Stuart Frankie Leukemia Foundation and been very busy in Michigan helping to further the battle. We do have to change gears before we let you go and hear some more of your music. And this is also a track available when you buy Stuart's ebook. It's called Summer Soldier, Holler If You if You Hear Me. Talk to us about that backup singer. It's a pretty familiar voice singing backup.
Yeah, you know. I did him a favor. Thought I might expose him to a larger audience.
All right, so tell everybody who they're going to hear.
It was a really great experience. It's Bruce Springsteen sang backup on this song, and we had met a few times at the Palace at backstage, and so I just asked straight away. I just asked straight away through his management. I didn't go through friends that we both knew or anything like that. And he replied in the affirmative. And pretty soon we got the files with his voice on it. We were like, my engineer and I were like little kids in a candy shop running around. You know, that's really Bruce. That's his voice. And so it turned out cool. It turned out really cool. And it was a very gracious thing of him to do.
The ebook is What Don't Kill Me Just Makes Me Stronger. Stuart Frankie, thank you so much and continued good health and happiness.
Thank you, Cynthia. If you hear me, if you hear me, if you hear me, if you hear me, 'cause I lay dying in this wasteland.